I'm Elizabeth Jackson. As part of the ABC's summer season, we now present a current affairs special. 2008 was a landmark year for Taiwan. The small but incredibly wealthy island just south of Japan nestled alongside its massive neighbour and frequent agitator China. With its fourth direct democratic presidential election, the self-governing island that China considers part of its own territory saw its second fully democratic change in power. An election year would usually see an escalation in tensions between China and Taiwan. Beijing would often test some missiles or boost forces along its east coast. This time, though, instead of the need for Allied warships to be parked offshore to ease tensions, China let democracy take its course across the strait, and the Taiwanese people obliged by installing a China-friendly leadership. Adam Connors reports on Taiwan's Year of Living Democracy.
When folk singer Chen Min-jung released his bittersweet 2001 album Last Train to Sual, Taiwan had just undergone a spectacular change in political power, the first democratic exchange of power in Chinese history. The Democratic Progressive Party, led by Taiwan-born Chen Shui-bian, swept into office in March 2000 on a key policy of providing a louder voice for ethnic Taiwanese. Sung in the native tongue, folk music in Taiwan is full of mourning. Historically, it's been settled, invaded, and sometimes ruled by the Dutch, the French, the Japanese, and China. And with the full-scale arrival of millions of mainland Chinese in 1949, a new chapter in the suppression of Aboriginal history began. Professor Shi Cheng-feng of Taiwan's Council for Indigenous Peoples explains.
In the old day, the government tried to assimilate the indigenous people. In other words, the government tried to turn them into Han Chinese, even during the Japanese rule. After World War II, the KMT moved in, and they do the same.
The indigenous-friendly and pro-independence DPP leadership was expected to elevate Taiwan's indigenous people, and to some extent it did.
In the past decade, the government has switched gear. In other words, they adopt the idea of indigenous rights and try to turn the old policy from welfare, tokenism, to the protection of indigenous rights.
By the year 2008, nearly 90% of the island's population of 23 million people are Taiwan-born. While the majority continue to be ethnically Han Chinese, their adoration of Aboriginal culture is now in the mainstream. Many consider it to be their own culture. Many consider themselves Taiwanese. And that's where it all gets a bit complicated.
The key issue in the Taiwan issue is sovereignty.
Speaking at the Carnegie Debate Series in early 2008, Alan Romberg is the director of the East Asia Program at the Henry L. Stimson Center in Washington, D.C.
PRC continues to insist, and it will continue to insist, that there is only one China, that Taiwan and the mainland are both parts of that one China, and that sovereignty and territory are indivisible. Taiwan obviously takes a different point of view, the notion that Taiwan or the Republic of China is a sovereign state and that it does not come under PRC aegis at all.
China demands that its borders remain intact, and any calls for Taiwanese independence, usually by the DPP, are met with unbridled venom. Arthur Waldron, a controversial academic and a China hawk, draws a fascinating parallel.
Mongolia, which was part of the Qing Empire before the Qing Empire included China, and which remained part of a Chinese empire after the Qing had disappeared for almost 300 years, Mongolia is now recognized as an independent country by China, whereas Chinese rule of Taiwan has been very limited indeed, even in the Qing dynasty. I once asked the Chinese foreign minister about this, and he really exploded at me, but he didn't answer my question. And, of course, foreign ministers are supposed to be able to answer hard questions. And later he sent somebody to see me who essentially said, well, we're all sort of very sad about Mongolia. We should never have let it happen. So they're very, very conflicted about this. But I think that increasingly reality is going to impose itself on this situation.
In the nearly 60 years since the conclusion of sorts of their civil war, the leaderships of both China and Taiwan have moved on from their daily artillery bombardments of each other. It's replaced instead with arguments over the definition of one China and what is diplomatically called a deliberate ambiguity on discussions of sovereignty. Realizing that both need to recognize each other in everyday matters such as business, an ambiguous status quo exists. There's peace and everyone can get rich. Peng Hongzhi is one of the 750,000 Taiwanese that now live and work in China, contributing hundreds of billions of dollars to both economies on either side of the straits. Far away from the Taiwanese-owned and China-run manufacturing plants dotted along China's east coast, and working from his art gallery in China's capital, Beijing, Hongzhi can't escape the politics.
When they talk about like Taiwan, like you coming from Taiwan, people in Beijing, they're really into politics. They always want to talk about politics. The most time they talk about is when maybe like dinner time and then eating together after some beer, and people like just ask you some really strict questions. That's kind of sometimes for the first time I got really scared. That they will ask you something about unification. It's like very, very strong, and we never faced that before. Like, you know, everybody has this idea about like to unify the whole country. But then Taiwan is part of China, and for us, like, of course, Taiwan is much more independent.
Did you have to hold back your responses?
It really depends. Like most time, I rather to say no. I don't want to touch about politics because, you know, like you're facing like 15 Chinese people has that idea and you don't want to argue with them. But sometimes it depends, like some people has much more open mind and then you can talk about this.
Election year 2008 was not greeted with much fanfare by the pro-independence DPP. After 8 years in power, it was on track to lose both the legislative and presidential elections, a train wreck that everyone could see coming from far off. Contesting the Taiwanese presidency, new DPP presidential candidate Frank Xie was looking pale in comparison to opposition superstar Ma Ying-jeou. With his movie star looks and a squeaky clean image, Ma Ying-jeou portrayed the new face of the opposition KMT, youthful, business-friendly and most importantly, China-friendly. In a peculiar quirk of history, the KMT, as the former rulers of China beaten to retreat to Taiwan by the communists in 1949, now represented China's preferred candidate, fundamentally due to its position that it would never call for Taiwanese independence from China. And the editor-in-chief of the pro-KMT China Times newspaper, Chen Lung-guo, says the DPP's tactics were simply looking old.
I think the Taiwan independence issues is somewhat in the process of beginning of a decline in Taiwan. And from now on, Taiwan will have more realistic interaction with China.
The first wound was to be delivered in January's legislative election. The KMT and its coalition partners won 81 of the 113 seats, soundly defeating the ruling DPP, which took only 27. Taking responsibility, Chen Shui-bian resigned as chairman of his party.
As we face what could be described as the greatest disaster since the founding of the Democratic Progressive Party, I have no excuse. I hereby announce that I'm resigning from my duties as party chairman, with immediate effect.
With the March 22 presidential elections looming, something disastrous would have to befall the KMT for Ma Ying-jeou to lose his lead. Typically for an election year, China would normally oblige by testing some missiles or by bolstering its forces on its east coast, directly facing Taiwan. But in this election year 2008, Beijing learnt from its mistakes. Noticing that their saber-rattling actually emboldens the anti-China vote, they took a subtle approach. This time there was just a strongly worded warning from a general of China's People's Liberation Army, Chen Bingde.
China's policy is peaceful reunification on Taiwan, but we have taken all the necessary preparations for independence activists. If anyone dares to take Taiwan away from the motherland, we have the capability and means to solve this issue and realize our goal.
Leading into the election, Ma Ying-jeou was staying on song, reminding the people that it was all about the economy.
To sum up, our economic policy must target Taiwan and benefit the people of Taiwan.
Then a week before the election, the rupture came. China cracked down heavily on large-scale Tibetan protests in its far west. Chen Shui-bian jumped immediately back onto the bandwagon.
Through suppressing Tibet, China has shown 23 million people of Taiwan that China is capable of using tanks and armed forces to kill the people of Tibet. The next one will be Taiwan.
Joining the DPP on the hustings was Chinese dissident and student leader in the 1989 Tiananmen Square protest, Wang Dun.
It happened before in 1989, the same time, the same place, the same matter. Therefore, I think it's a signal showing that maybe there are lots of serious social problems when China is enjoying its economic prosperity. The Beijing government can only use force to suppress, but not other methods. This is very dangerous.
With the crackdown in China's annexed province to the west, the political stick that the DPP traditionally wielded against the KMT became a bludgeoning instrument. But stoking Taiwanese fear of closer China ties was not to work this time. Ma Ying-jeou bounded over the Tibet issue to pick up more than 58% of the votes to win the presidency. In the moments following his win, the president-elect reaffirmed his agenda of closer ties with China and even the prospect of a formal peace treaty.
We would like to start preliminary contact with the mainland on how a peace treaty could be signed, particularly when we already said very clearly, if we are to negotiate a peace treaty, they have to remove the missiles targeted against Taiwan, because we don't want to negotiate peace under the threat of war.
Chen Longguo of the China Times newspaper puts the president's remarks into perspective, again with that spin of deliberate ambiguity.
This is not to say that Taiwan will be unified with China. But this is certainly not going to mean that Taiwan is going to separate from China. It's going to be a more realistic way to interact with China.
For as Douglas Pyle, a former US official who's worked on both sides of the straits, told the Carnegie debate series, China-friendly doesn't necessarily mean pro-China.
Despite many of the characterizations and some, I think, wrongly written headlines, Mr. Ma is not pro-China. He is a man who's very patriotically pro-Taiwan. He understands some flexibility is needed to do better things for Taiwan in its cross-strait economic and other relations with the mainland.
Indeed, as the sovereignty debate cooled with Taiwan's new presidency and a majority KMT parliament, China's leadership could look again at the bottom line. Taiwan, while only two-fifths the size of the Australian island state of Tasmania, has the fourth largest trade surplus in the world after China, Japan and Russia. It's the 17th largest economy in the world. Its GDP is only slightly less than Australia, but more than the Netherlands and Saudi Arabia. And half of its 24-year-olds has a university education, 60% with engineering degrees. While still in a political stasis, both sides of the strait could not argue the fact that direct trade, tourist flights, shipping cargo and even mail would stimulate both economies significantly. So it was then that China and Taiwan recommenced negotiations in mid-2008 for direct trade links after a nearly 60-year hiatus. China's vice chief of cross-strait relations, Jiang Mingqing, led an advanced party in negotiations to Taiwan in late October. That's the sound of an alleged card-carrying member of the DPP jumping up and down on the roof of the Chinese envoy's car. Jostled by protesters on a tour of a Confucian temple in Tainan, Jiang Mingqing fell to the ground at one point, surrounded by protesters shouting Taiwan does not belong to China. It played endlessly on Taiwan television for days. But Jiang Mingqing was just the advanced guard. Taiwan's anti-unification forces and the DPP were planning for the November visits of China's head of cross-strait relations, Chen Yun-lin. The new opposition DPP leader, Tsai Ing-wen, set the agenda.
The government's approach in dealing with the Chinese affairs is extremely, extremely worrisome to people here. It is not tough enough, it is not firm enough, it is soft without justification.
A rally on October 25 paralysed Taiwan's capital, Taipei, just a week before the PRC's senior diplomat was to arrive. Most Taiwanese and international media put the figures in the hundreds of thousands. Some say 500,000 people walked the streets. But as the highest level visit by China to its political rival wrapped up in early November, signing on to direct daily routes across the strait as well as other ties, it was, in all intents and purposes, an economic coup, and maybe just one of the many planks that Taiwan and China need to make sense of their deliberate ambiguity. Eternal skeptic Arthur Waldron is watching closely.
I think Ma is actually pursuing a rather risky, it's a high-stakes game. If he succeeds, settlement will benefit everybody. And it's really up to China whether he's going to succeed or not, because he has already yielded a great deal. I mean, going so far as to take down national flags where Chinese visitors are going to go, which alienated people in Taiwan from him. He's undermining his own political base in Taiwan. His popularity has dropped to something like 23% from 58% and plus. So he's really going out on a limb. And if the Chinese don't, you know, help him to resolve this, then they will have lost an opportunity.
Professor Bruce Jacobs of Australia's Monash University has worked and studied in both Taipei and Nanjing.
I don't think he'll have any greater influence at all. I think the situation as China has shaped it, and a very famous professor has argued that China has, what to use her terms, has boxed itself in on what it calls on what are nationalistic issues. So on issues like Taiwan, like Tibet, dealings with Japan, it's very hard for the leadership to maneuver, and I think that'll continue.
Agreeing with Professor Jacobs, Arthur Waldron dares to say what no one else can.
I think that they have dug a hole for themselves there, and it just sticks in their throat to deal with what is the reality. I mean, if the word state means anything at all in English, it certainly applies to Taiwan. And if the word country means anything, I think it does.
After all the insecurity of Taiwan's year of living democracy, it seems there's only one person who's finishing the year on the same low in which it began. Former DPP leader and Taiwan President Chen Shui-bian started the year with his party facing defeat and ended the year indicted, along with his family, for corruption and money laundering. Singing here pretty badly. On a 1996 fundraising album, Chen Shui-bian crooned his dreams of carrying the burden. Born into poverty in Taiwan's south and rising to its presidency, he powerfully sold that burden of Taiwan's sovereignty and identity for 8 years as the island's leader. With Taiwan and China's cross-strait relations at the beginning of a fascinating new period, it remains to be seen if this son of Taiwan will ever be able to rest.
Adam Connors with that report, and you've been listening to A Current Affairs Special.